Okay, we left off yesterday talking about abnormally dangerous activities as one way of establishing strict liability. Today we shift to a different form of strict liability, a different basis for strict liability. Interestingly, the same case, Fletcher versus Ryland, sort of gave birth to both of these theories or bases of strict liability. So let's start just kind of getting the facts on the table here and following the progression of the case as it goes from one court to another. Ms. Nelson, can you tell us about Fletcher versus Rylance? Okay, so apparently, as the court said at one time, the mine shafts over here on the defendant's property and the mine shafts on the plaintiff's property were connected, communicated with each other. But this apparently was not known to the people who were building the reservoir. So when they excavate this and then they fill it up with water, the water burst through these the bottom of this reservoir and infiltrates the plaintiff's property. So the plaintiff's trying to recover for the damages to his property caused by this flooding. And what's the plaintiff's argument as to why he ought to be compensated? So one argument is negligence, lack of reasonable care. This is sort of by way of review here. This is old business. And just while we're doing that, a little bit of review here, what if it turned out that the people who were doing the actual digging had some sort of notice of, gee, as they're digging this a big pit for the reservoir, they come across evidence that at one time this area had been worked as a mine. Could you then hold the owner of the property, the defendant, vicariously liable for their negligence in continuing to dig after they became aware of the problem? Well, but what do we know about the law that would either allow or not allow such a claim against the defendant? Could you hold the owner vicariously liable for what was done by the people digging the reservoir? Again, by way of review here, this is not the new material. This is going back to our stuff on vicarious liability. If you can show what? But you also have to show something about the relationship between the people doing the digging and the owner. Ms. Anderson? Okay, so the distinction that we draw, whether vicarious liability applies or not, is if somebody is your employee, you are vicariously liable if they act negligently in the course and scope of their employment. But if you hire someone who is determined to be an independent contractor, you're not vicariously liable for their negligence. So the question would be, are the people digging this reservoir considered employees or are they considered independent contractors? And that in turn, Ms. Anderson was saying, depends upon whether or not the defendant has the right to control the way they do the work. So if, for example, and that might be a close question in a construction kind of case, but oftentimes if it involves using heavy equipment and figuring out how to dig something and construct a reservoir, I'm going to rely on somebody else, on an architect, upon a, you know, someone who knows about how to do these sorts of things. I won't interfere and go tell them, gee, you ought to dig deeper here, or use the backhoe here, or use a bulldozer, or do this with shovels. I will defer to their expertise and not exert a right to control. So again, just by way of review here, there is no vicarious liability if the people who do the negligent act are considered independent contractors. Okay, so there is a negligence theory that's being proposed here, but as it turns out, the court, and by the way, we should say something here about the nature of the court. Alas, we don't have time with all the other stuff we've got to do in the first year curriculum to give you a full immersion into the pageantry of English law that we inherited a lot of stuff from England, and some of them are sort of recognizable in our own ways of doing things, but some are the peculiarities of what happened in a particular era. As it turns out, this particular case is filed in the Court of the Exchequer being roughly analogous to the Treasury Department, and they had a set of courts that heard cases and imposed judgments and so forth. As we'll see as we go further up the chain here, how that fits into the other aspects of the political system. But again, the plaintiff files this claim originally in the Court of the Exchequer, and the court, in a part of the opinion I don't provide for you, essentially looks at the allegation that the defendant was negligent and decides they weren't negligent. But there's another basis for the plaintiff to try to recover, and what's that? Even if the defendant wasn't negligent, says the plaintiff, I should recover because okay, but just because I've been injured by the defendant doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to apply strict liability. If I'm walking down the street and I get run over by a car, I can't say that I want the defendant to be held strictly liable, or if I do, the court won't be very impressed with my argument. Why is it that the plaintiff says in this case the defendant is subject to strict liability? Okay, trespass or a related concept, which is nuisance. That is, technically they're related in the way this isn't something I spend a lot of energy on. Trespass is tended to be thought of as a direct physical invasion, like, you know, trespassing on somebody's property or throwing rocks or depositing soot or ash or that sort of thing. That's considered trespass, whereas nuisance is a more ethereal kind of interference. So heavy traffic flow or noise or that kind of stuff, odors, are considered a nuisance as distinguished from a direct physical invasion of a trespass. This actually could probably be considered a trespass, but the court winds up talking about nuisance. Okay, what's the plaintiff's argument that this is a nuisance? Pardon? Well, that's one of them. Is it a nuisance? And let's get to that. What does the court say as to whether or not it is a nuisance or not? Okay. And it's not a nuisance either. Why not? It has to be what? Okay. And there's also some other characteristic of a nuisance that you can't say about this. For example, suppose you have a pig farm and the pigs generate all sorts of, you know, waste and smells and they make such a hideous noise when you kill them. Why is that a nuisance but this isn't? according to the court. Say that again. Well, it's not by running a pig farm. I really don't like pigs myself, but I got pigs so that I could annoy my neighbor. It's not intentional in that sense, but there's a distinction between what happens in a pig farm and what happens with this reservoir. What's the distinction that the court wants to draw here, Ms. Olmsted? In the ordinary operation of the reservoir, it doesn't generate odors or noise or the like. It's probably actually a nice thing to have next door. But as it turns out, when the water escapes, as it did in this case, it causes injury. So the court says, in order to be a nuisance, it's got to be something which in itself is offensive or obnoxious or noxious, I should say. And in this case, that isn't true of the reservoir in its ordinary condition. But not everybody agrees. Baron Bramwell writes a dissenting opinion. And what's his view of the case? Okay, and he says the plaintiff has a right to be free of foreign water, not water imported from France, but, you know, water coming from his neighbor's reservoir. So to the extent that the plaintiff sitting in his coal mine, minding his own business, is suddenly, bowled over by this flood of water, from his perspective, from the plaintiff's perspective, this is an invasion of his rights. And Bramwell thinks that in itself is sufficient to justify a recovery for the plaintiff. But again, Bramwell's in the minority here. He's only one voice, and he's outvoted. But the plaintiff takes heart in that and appeals the case. And as we go up the food chain here, from the court of the Exchequer, we then rise to the level of the Exchequer Chamber, which is like a court of appeals here, a more select group. And we get another opinion now from Justice Blackburn. What's Blackburn's view of the case? Say that again. Okay, but we're not reverting to some kind of vicarious liability here. It's not because of the negligence of the contractors. As you say, Blackburn agrees with Bramwell that the plaintiff has a right on the basis of strict liability to recover for the damage that the defendant caused. Now, part of what Blackburn is trying to do is to explain why we're using a rule in this case that is different from, say, the rule that would apply if I'm walking down the street and I got run over by a car. If I want to hold the driver of the car liable, I would like to be able to argue that I have a right to be free of foreign transmissions and windshields and whatever, and to the extent that they're now lodged in my backside, I want the defendant to compensate for the trouble of removing them. But in a case like that, I wouldn't be able to get the judge to apply a rule of strict liability. The judge would only hold the defendant liable, let's say if he had an epileptic seizure like the guy in Hammond III versus Jenner, he's only liable if we can prove that he was negligent. Why is it that we apply a different rule to the plaintiff in Rylands versus Fletcher from the kind of rule we apply to somebody driving down the street. Where's the logic in that? We could do a kind of social justice argument in which we say, gee, the poor plaintiff sitting there, you know, in his coal mine, if he doesn't get compensated, the rest of us, you know, we really need him to be compensated. But Blackburn's got a more theoretical argument here in which he says there's a distinction between the kind of rule we apply to people in one situation as compared to the rule that we apply here. And what is that distinction? You're off, Chuck? Say that again for me. You're out, Chuck? Okay. Okay, and notice the way in which this sort of picks up the idea we talked about, I think, a little bit earlier, this idea of a non-reciprocal risk. That is, without getting too theoretical about it, the idea here is that when you go out on the highway, you and the drivers next to you are kind of each taking your chances, and all you can expect of the guy next to you and all that he can expect of you is that you use reasonable care. If an accident happens through nobody's fault, it's nobody's fault. And if you don't like those conditions, maybe you should think twice about whether you get out on the highway. By contrast, the plaintiff sitting in his fine and private place in his coal mine, on what basis can we tell him, well, you know, these things just sort of happen. Yeah, your neighbor built this reservoir, but we can't find him at fault, and therefore you you'll just have to clean up afterward. Instead, as Bramwell said, and Blackburn agrees, the plaintiff has a right to be free of foreign water. Now, again, what's peculiar about this, in a sense, is that the plaintiff has this very specific property right. That is, he owns a coal mine. He's paid taxes on it. He's, you know, paying a mortgage on it or otherwise invested in it. And it is the protection of that property right that generates the law's protection or its willingness to compensate him, force the defendant to compensate him. Again, by contrast, the person that goes out on the highway is taking their chances. And to some extent, one of the things you want to sort of think about is the extent to which the cases that we look at involve people who are encountering one another on the highway, so to speak, out there where everybody's taking their own chances, and the extent to which the cases we're looking at involve someone who, minding their own business, gets clobbered while they're sitting in the privacy of their living room or what have you. Where we had a case before where the plaintiff was essentially minding his or her own business and the defendant's activity comes hurtling through the window, Mr. Sullivan? Well, Bierman was one, and in Bierman we wound up deciding that at least some form of res ipsa loquitur would apply. But we had another case, Ms. Rush. There's some of that too. But I'm also thinking about Hammond Tree versus Jenner. Remember, the guys, they're not actually at home, but they're in their bicycle shop. The defendant's car comes hurtling through the window. You might have asked whether or not the plaintiffs in that case would have been entitled to a rule of similar to Rylance versus Fletcher, whether the argument for strict liability is not people who drive around with a seizure disorder should be strictly liable if they have a seizure and can't control their car. maybe the plaintiff in Hammondtree versus Jenner should have tried to argue strict liability on the basis, sort of like Rylands versus Fletcher. Other people who venture out on the highway can only expect people, even people with seizure disorders, simply to use reasonable care. But if you're adjusting the derailleur or tightening up the spokes, and all of a sudden the defendant's car comes through your window, then maybe on the basis of Rylands versus Fletcher, you ought to be able to say that sort of invasion is subject to strict liability. Maybe. But no one raised that at the time, interestingly enough. Okay, there's a last opinion in Rylands versus Fletcher. The defendant won in the trial court, but now the plaintiffs won in the next court. We finally get to the top of the food chain, and what is the court at the top of the food chain here? Yeah, what court is this being heard in? Yeah, it's the House of Lords. And what is the House of Lords? How does it fit into the British political system? It would be analogous to what American institution? What part of the Congress? The Senate. So we have, you know, the Brits have this, you know, they have the House of Lords, which is sort of like their Senate, and then they have the House of Commons, which is like the House of Representatives. We kind of borrowed this idea of a bicameral legislature representing different sort of segments of society or different kinds of interests, hoping that the diversity of viewpoints would provide further protection against tyranny. So again, the House of Lords, like the U.S. Senate, imagine appealing the Ninth Circuit's opinion on the California recall election to the U.S. Senate, as opposed to appealing it to the Supreme Court. We take it for granted that part of our system has this separation of powers in which the judiciary is over here, running on essentially an independent track, and we've got the legislature and the executive and we place a lot of importance in constitutional law on maintaining this separation of powers. Here, the British system has this, what to us would be, unusual system in which the legislative, or a body that has sort of legislative attributes, is at the top of the judicial system. Of course, the Brits also have never had a written constitution. We think a written constitution is an important piece of security, again, to assure that the rights we enjoy are easily identified and easily defended. Brits, by contrast, have never had a written constitution, and yet function as a relatively open democracy. So again, it's a little bit of a surprise here. Yeah. I'm sorry, where are you? Page 56, which column? Oh, yeah, right. Well, I think what they're saying here was we have, we wanted to make sure we're saying nothing about the measure of damages. All we're saying is the judgment for the defendants was correct. So the only thing they're saying, in effect, is that the defendant was not entitled to judgment on the nuisance question, but it will. They're saying nothing about what the damages should be or whether there are any damages for that matter. Okay. All right, so again, we're now here at the House of Lords. What does the House of Lords add to this discussion, if anything? Okay, so here in the House of Lords opinion, we get more of the flavor of what eventually became Ziegler versus Kuhlman, the idea that the defendant takes a risk, and we're grateful for the benefits that derive from people who go around carrying gasoline or people who build reservoirs and construct various improvements, but when people do those things, they take on the liability for that enterprise going sour on them. And again, distinguishing it from those cases where there is simply the natural accumulation of water where the defendant hasn't done anything to increase the risk or make the world more dangerous. The defendant has simply presided over the land at a time when there were unusual floods or somehow this thing eventually flooded the plaintiff's property. So again, what you have is kind of mixed up together here in Rylands versus Fletcher is on the one hand this idea of the special attention that we give to property owners and their right to be free of invasion by the defendant's activities, and at the same time, the idea that a defendant who does something abnormally dangerous has to be accountable for the unexpected fallout from that activity. Okay, now, we've sort of established this principle that there is such a thing as nuisance, and that when you are found to have engaged in a nuisance, you're strictly liable for it. But we haven't really defined what a nuisance is or how it's identified. And so we turn to Bohan for guidance on that point. And in Bohan, I labored long and hard to provide you with a visual diagram of what happened in Bohan here with the defendant's operation of a gaslight factory generating fumes and noxious odors that caused the plaintiff much distress. And the plaintiff says, I'm entitled to damages caused by the defendant's operation of this gaslight factory. But the defendant's not so sure about that. Mr. King, can you tell us about Bohan? Okay. Ms. Dykes, can you tell us about Bohan? So what happens at trial of the case? I think just the opposite, actually. They wound up finding for the plaintiff. Okay, yes. At the trial court, they found for the plaintiff, but the defendant's unhappy, obviously. Defendant appeals. What's the defendant's complaint on appeal? What went wrong? Go ahead. Okay, so the defendant says, before you call this thing a nuisance and hold me liable, you've got to point to something about my operation which is a substandard. If I've got a state-of-the-art gaslight plant that's using the latest technology and following the best practices, then you can't call that a nuisance. I mean, look at all the benefits that society gains from gaslight, and I'm not liable just because there's some unfortunate side effects which can't be prevented through the use of reasonable care. Now, right away, what would we think about an argument along those lines that unless you show that my conduct didn't meet the standard of reasonable care, the plaintiff can't recover? What logically doesn't make sense about that argument? Why would it not make sense for the plaintiff to say, why would it not make sense for the defendant to say, you can't find my operation to be a nuisance unless you find that I'm negligent? Ms. Rush? Then there would be no point in talking about nuisance at all. You would simply have, well, this would just be an old negligence case again. If that's all we were talking about, it would just be another name for negligence, but it's probably not that. There's some special bite that we get from the fact that we call it a nuisance. So, in getting to the bottom line here, what does the court say in response to the defendant's argument that the jury should have been instructed to find it a nuisance only if they were somehow unskillful or handled it in an unreasonable way? What does the court say to that? Okay, one way of saying is that a reasonable person would never do such a thing, but I'm not quite sure I would agree with that as a general proposition. But in effect, they say that a nuisance can be established by showing the damage to the plaintiff without necessarily imputing to the defendant some kind of negligent conduct. You may be doing the best job you can to run a gaslight factory, but nonetheless it results in injury to the plaintiff. And if the plaintiff can show this injury, the plaintiff's entitled to recover. Mr. Johnson? Well, industry custom would go to the question of whether or not the defendant's behaving reasonably. That is, you compare the defendant, well, how are other people managing their gaslight factories? If I can show, hey, I'm getting awards for, gaslight factory of the year, I'm the best there is within my industry, so what, says the plaintiff, says the court. It injures the plaintiff, and therefore it's a nuisance. Isn't that what they say, in effect? Well, to the extent that the plaintiff is relying upon a nuisance theory, which is a strict liability theory, the plaintiff doesn't want to play the game of negligence. The plaintiff wants to say, I've made out a case for nuisance. I'm sitting in my house trying to cook dinner, and all of a sudden the place smells like whatever, a petroleum factory, and it's noxious and unreasonable. Mr. McElveen. Yes. Sure. And part of the question is whether or not the people, and obviously we're anticipating that in the next series of cases, what happens when there is a socially beneficial activity, in this case, field burning, which stimulates the growth of the grass that generates the grass seed and is a substantial industry in eastern Washington. How do we balance that against the health hazards resulting from the clouds of smoke generated by field burn? Yeah. And obviously we see a case not dissimilar from that in Spur versus Del Webb when we get there. But for the moment here, we're still trying to figure out what is a nuisance. And the defendant wants to say a nuisance is somebody behaving unreasonably. And the court says no, nuisance can occur even when the defendant's doing something that's reasonable, but it causes injury to the plaintiff. Now, let me see if I understand this correctly. Let's suppose I earn my living as a musician, and most of my activity is on the weekend. I do play some during the week, but the big money is playing Friday and Saturday night. And so Friday, about 6 or 7 o'clock, I show up at the club, meet my fellow band members, get everything tuned up, medicate myself. And then about 9 o'clock, I start playing, play another set later on, have dinner at 1 or 2 in the morning, do other stuff, finally get back home, roll into bed about 4 or 5 in the morning. But Saturday morning, my neighbor, who's not a musician, gets out his lawnmower and starts it up and starts mowing his lawn. And, I try leaving a little note for him to say, please, I need my sleep, and could you please wait to mow your lawn until later? And he turns the card over and writes on the back and saying, sorry, I have other things to do, and get used to it. Now, suppose we can't resolve this, and these two, the musician and his lawn mowing neighbor, show up at Judge Judy's courtroom or Judge Wapner's courtroom and say, we can't resolve this, you resolve it for us. The musician says, my neighbor's lawn mowing is a nuisance. What do you think Judge Judy or Judge Wapner would say? First of all, what's the standard? A nuisance is what? How do we define a nuisance? Ms. Rush? Okay. They're not actually hurtful to the plaintiff. Right. It's the defendant's doing of something that hurts the plaintiff. Defendant builds a reservoir, defendant's water hurts the plaintiff, damages his property, Mrs. Bierman, whatever. So the musician says, fine, I'll take that definition. Your lawn mowing disturbs my sleep. Are you going to call that a nuisance? Okay. So on what? So now we have to define. We have to refine our definition of nuisance. A nuisance is something which causes damage to the plaintiff and what else? Okay, Ms. Amadapour? Well, gee, now we're sounding like the defendant in Bohan, aren't we? The guy running the gaslight factory says, fine, you can hold me liable for a nuisance, but only if you show I behaved unreasonably. And I thought we rejected that. But now somehow when the musician comes in front of us and wants to have the lawnmower guy declared a nuisance, we're suddenly more receptive to the idea that reasonableness has something to do with it. Yeah. okay, you're paying attention to which walnut, the walnut shell the pea is under here. I've been moving these things around here, and if you weren't watching closely, you would have missed the fact that the term reasonableness has been moved over from talking about the defendant's conduct to talking about whether the plaintiff is reasonable in expecting his neighbor to let him sleep. Now, obviously, if the lawn mowing neighbor had a 7 o'clock tea time and wanted to have his lawn mowed before he went off to play golf, if he's out there at 6 in the morning firing up his lawnmower, then Judge Judy or Judge Wapner probably would say, this is a nuisance. Now, the difference is you might think that mowing your lawn at 9 a.m. is reasonable, whereas mowing your lawn at 6 a.m. is unreasonable, but again, you could mistakenly think that the focus is on the defendant. The focus is really on the plaintiff in a nuisance case to say, is it reasonable for us as a society to expect the people sitting in their house to put up with the stink from the gaslight factory, or are those people reasonable in saying, hey, I'm all for gaslight, use it myself, but I don't see why I should have to put up with the stink being generated by the factory. Ms. Rush? Yes. Right. Well, I was casting no aspersions on musicians. Some of my best friends are musicians. There's nothing wrong with the. I was kidding about the medication part. The activity, yeah, it could just as easily apply to a night watchman or a nurse who's, you know, on shift from 11 to 7. Same principle would be, in effect, could a person with however noble their occupation, could they reasonably expect their neighbors to, you know, tiptoe around the neighborhood until it's time for them to get up? Or would you rather say, in effect, your intuitive response is get better insulating windows or curtains, or, you know, find some other part of the house to sleep in where you won't be disturbed by hearing a lawnmower, because no judge is going to tell the neighborhood to only mow your lawn between the hours of 3 and 4 in the afternoon. That isn't going to happen. So, in effect, we have a similar kind of balancing process that takes place as between the interests of the plaintiff and the interests of the defendant, and that balancing process, that reasonableness thing, sounds a lot like our old friend, the standard of reasonable care, but in fact, as was pointed out, we've shifted the focus from the defendant to the plaintiff. It's no longer looking at whether the defendant is negligent by our traditional standard. Rather, the focus is to say, how reasonable is the plaintiff's expectation that they can enjoy their property free from this intrusion? So getting back to the question of the field burning, it's a classic kind of problem to say, particularly for people who suffer from acute respiratory disease, cystic fibrosis or asthma or other kinds of breathing impairments, for them the field burning is not just an inconvenience, it can be potentially life-threatening. But the question is, well, if you don't like it, why don't you move west of the fields rather than, you know, why should the rest of us forego the economically valuable activity of field burning when it's really just a small minority of people for whom this is more than just an inconvenience? And it's in that balancing process that you have your work cut out for you, that you have to figure out how are we going to reconcile these two? Mr. Viviano? Right. It's a little bit unclear here. I've also edited some of this out here, and I can't remember what was in the original case report, whether, because most of what we know about the case is found in the dissenting opinion. So there may be some, you know, it may be the plaintiff did a better job of pleading the nuisance issue than what shows up in the report here, but you're right to be your antenna have obviously become sensitized to the fact of, did the plaintiff argue the right theories at the trial court level, or is this the appellate court again, like Siegler versus Kuhlman, introducing a theory at the appellate court level that the plaintiff never bothered to argue below? Ms. Olmstead? Oh, absolutely. There are, and this is something that you'll take up in civil procedure, the idea of pleading in the alternative. That's the expression that's used. So that, for example, let's suppose you're injured in an automobile collision, and after the collision, it's unclear who of two people was driving. You know, one person's drunk as a skunk, and the other person is sober. And according to them, the sober person was driving, and they just got, you know, twisted around after the accident. But you think it was the drunk person who was driving, but you can still plead in the alternative to say, my belief is, you know, that I think this person was driving. In the alternative, if it turns out this other thing, then here's my pitch on that. So oftentimes, at least in the beginning stages of a case, you are allowed to plead in the alternative. You can also, that's a factual discrepancy. I don't know whether it's this fact or that fact that'll turn out to be true. Even more generous is the provision for pleading alternative legal theories. So I'm not pleading an inconsistent set of facts. I know that, for example, the dynamite factory blew up. Or I know that in Siegler versus Kuhlman, the tanker overturned and burned the plaintiff, but I'll plead alternative legal theories. My first argument is that the defendant was negligent. My second theory is that the defendant is subject to strict liability. And when I plead this originally, I don't know which of those two is going to turn out to be the more promising theory. It may turn out that the evidence for negligence is very strong, and I find out that the case for strict liability is weak, or vice versa. Typically, just in terms of the sequence of it, you will first resolve, as a matter of law, the strict liability theory. And if the plaintiff wins that, the case is over. We just go up on appeal on that. But if the court says, no, I don't think there's strict liability here, then you would proceed to try the case on the basis of negligence. And then if you lost there, you'd follow that appellate logic as well. Again, that was one of the things in Siegler versus Kuhlman that's puzzling. Why didn't the plaintiff plead in the alternative to say, I think the defendant was negligent via res ipsa loquitur, that's the way I'm going to prove it, but in the alternative, I think they're subject to strict liability. I don't know if I'll win on my strict liability theory, but what's the harm in pleading it and not having the court bail you out of the plaintiff's failure to do that. Okay, so we will pick up with Boomer tomorrow, Mr. Brown. Oh, we will, because we'll get to that in Del Webb in the Spur Industries case, because there's a discussion of public and private nuisance. Yeah.